At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined, as always, by my partner in all things strategy, Elliot Cohen, who's professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you?
As always, personally, I'm just fine. And, you know, on other fronts, rather dismayed. But looking forward to our guest, who is somebody that we've both known for a while in a very different context and brings me back to a previous life. But I'll let you take it from there.
Great. All right. Well, our guest is Alexander Vindman, the author of The Folly of Realism, How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is an Army officer, retired, but also former director for European affairs on the National Security Council staff, and of course, a witness at the hearings that led to the impeachment of Donald J. Trump back in 2019 and his trial in 2020. Unfortunately, he didn't get to be a witness in the trial because there were no witnesses in the trial, but that's another story. Alex, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you very much. I've been looking forward to this one more than almost any other engagement because you are two people I deeply admire. Elliot, who was a lifesaver, brought me in to do my doctoral studies at SAIS as a, you know, frankly, as a, what's the, a fairy godmother or whatever is like a light, the male
herself.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever the other version of that is where, you know, you swooped in and were an angel. You know, when I found myself forced out of the military and Eric, I remember our conversation vividly. You were frankly the one of the most frank and thoughtful interview subjects for this book. Really looking forward to chatting.
Well, great. Let me get right into it. So one of the leitmotifs of this book is that policymakers since the Soviet Union collapsed have prioritized Russia. It's something that Elliot and I have talked about on this podcast with others, with Dan Fried, with Steve Pfeiffer and John Herbst and others who've worked in this vineyard. And you talk about the fact that the relationship between the United States and Russia and therefore Ukraine was always transactional, and the Ukrainian relationship was always subordinated to the requirements of the moment in U.S.-Russia relations. And I think that's a fair enough indictment of U.S. policy over the last 35 years. But I do wonder, and I'd love to hear you talk about this, because you were an attaché both in Kyiv and in Moscow, so you've seen it from both sides of the equation, whether it underplays to some degree the agency of the Ukrainians here. I mean, I remember when I was working on these issues with Strobe Talbot twice at the outset of the Clinton administration and then in the kind of middle of the Clinton administration, that Strobe used to describe the Ukrainians as very hard to help, which I think is fair. I mean, you had a lot of issues in Ukraine with corruption, with governments that found it, and parliaments that found it very difficult to reform, to move away from the old Soviet model. You talk about the fact that Ukraine was constantly being compared unfavorably to the reform going on next door in Poland. But to what degree did the Ukrainians contribute to this failure, you know, in policy terms?
Sure. So give me a little leash because I want to explain a little bit of why I wrote this book, seeing the patterns unfold over about 35 years. You know, the bottom line is that it became clear to me that there were some significant inputs that resulted in both the war the initial phase of the war in 2014 and 2022. And as I looked at it, clearly the U.S. was favoring its policy with Russia. And, you know, some of that superficially is understandable. Massive nuclear arsenal, massive conventional force, huge country, lots of commodities. So both opportunities and risks. And I describe it as hopes and fears throughout the entirety of that 35-year relationship. Hopes that we could accomplish more with Russia, and fears that if we were either too harsh, conditional, condemnatory, that we would trigger, you know, a return to the worst, what we thought would be the worst case scenario, which was another Cold War, not recognizing that there might be even something more dangerous on the horizon. And I frankly believe I'm pretty forgiving about the 90s and maybe even the early 2000s, certainly the 90s, because of the enormous hopes of exiting the Cold War and this idea of pan-European security, the noises that the Russian leadership were making, some steps that they made forward in the 90s with regards to transformation, but also missed a lot of the warning signs along the way. You know, we're talking about the their illiberal action to suppress communist reactionary forces at multiple points in the 90s. A firing on the parliamentary building, 1996, with the second election of Yeltsin, Chechnya, the saber rattling, or the Russia's, you know, kind of, I wouldn't even say saber rattling, but it's coercion of its former subordinate republics throughout that period of time, you know, with a high degree of threat over attempting to regain some of the lost territories like Crimea. There were number of notable instances, and including, frankly, in the early 2000s, shots fired in the Crimea, in the Tuzla Island episode. And then the Ukrainians, you know, also being very, very difficult, initially enticing us with both being an important player, you know, less so than Russia, but an important player in the region, but still significant. Both President Clinton and Gore talked about these two being the kind of linchpin of our policy towards the region. And, you know, denuclearization was a critical factor. They had both countries had our attention fixed until at least Ukraine gave up its nuclear arsenal in 96. By the time you get into the 2000s and the turn of Russia to controlled by a KGB case officer that took a much, much more aggressive anti-liberal and anti-democratic turn, suppressing opposition, killing, you know, going so far as to kill opposition. Forget about like the lighter stuff on the spectrum, like suppressing opposition media and things of that nature. You have Ukraine, you know, also being faltering at times. We had a very, very difficult relationship with Ukraine in the late 90s and early 2000s where they were, you know, putting the screws to our investments and our business interests. This was a regular topic of discussion in the Gore-Kuchma commission meetings about what, you know, can, if we're trying to help you, let us help you type of thing. But then you get into the Orange Revolution in 2004. And that was a really pretty critical turning point. You know, a lot could be forgiven before, but after that point, we really did stumble. I think we were allured by the promise of working with Russia on fighting global terrorism. Bush famously with and personal relationships are critical, looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul. All those types of things. And we missed an opportunity to, when Ukraine did pivot hard towards a Western track, you know, trying to catch up on lost time, we didn't do nearly enough to support their transformation in that period of time. You know, yes, there were a lot of internal dynamics and fighting, but we could have done a lot more. And a lot of the reasons that we stayed our hand is because we didn't want to jeopardize our relationship with Russia. And this is in a moment where Russia was really, you know, in the post Orange Revolution period, was saying that the U.S. was interfering in its own backyards, was looking to, Ukraine was a template for regime change in Russia. And then you have, by the time you get to Georgia, all the warning signs were there. I mean, John McCain was very, very bold in his declarations of where the dangers were. I think Hillary Clinton also was actually pretty assertive that we needed to do more. And it's not like these conversations weren't occurring behind closed doors, you know, throughout this period, either with Cheney as the Secretary of Defense or as the Vice President talking about a Russia that's revanchist, you know, looking back to building empire. And we just continued to favor this Moscow approach, a Russia first policy, instead of making some adjustments.
So if I could, the I should explain to our listeners, and the book is actually, it's in a way three books, and it's a relatively brief book, so it's an accomplishment to do this. There is a piece with just the narrative of U.S.-Ukrainian relations and how that fits into our overall politics towards Russia. There's some of your own story throughout this, which is, I think, particularly interesting. And then there's a argument, which is, I suppose, a little bit more theoretical, which is about the role of realism in American foreign policy as opposed to idealism. The question that I wanted to ask you, as I was reading this, what I was thinking, is how, to what extent were the roots of the problem, and I'm reflecting, you know, my own view of what I think I've seen, that we didn't really take Ukraine, the idea of Ukraine, seriously as a nation. I mean, it's, in other words, we sort of bought off on the Russian view that it's, you know, kind of a subordinate part of Russia. Yes, this is where Russia originated with Kievan Rus, but it's not really, you know, these are people basically speaking a dialect of Russian, and they're all a little bit kind of crazy anyway. But in any case, it's not a real country, unlike Poland, which we recognize as a real country, and Lithuania is a real country, and so forth. And, you know, that, I think that played an important role into the crisis of 21-22. And I have to think it was playing an even larger role earlier on. Is that, do you think that's right? Or am I off base?
I think that's exactly right. I think the fact is that, you know, we are poor students of history and didn't understand the struggles of the Ukrainians and, you know, the interaction between the Ukrainians and the Russians for 1,000 years, you know, where initially the precursor to Russia was subordinate, and then emerged as a dominant power after, you know, Kievan Rus was finally crushed by the Mongol hordes, and then you know, these two regions come into tension in the 17th century. The Ukrainians attempting to carve out their own separate state and looking for friends when they had a tough neighborhood with regards to the Poland, Polish-Lithuanian Empire, and Ottoman Empire, and they went with their Eastern Orthodox, you know, kind of cousins, and that the Russians took that as the license to dominate the region. But the Ukrainians didn't. I mean, that was a long, even from that period forward, that was a long 350 years of the Ukrainians still struggling for their own identity, with brief moments of autonomy, followed by subordination in Russia's weakness in World War I, independence, and then subordination in the Soviet Union, but still with a strong enough, sufficiently strong identity to demand of Lenin that, you know, that Ukraine be its own republic. Frankly, the seeds of the Soviet collapse being planted back then, and they flowered, of course, in 1991 when the Ukrainian population voted overwhelmingly in 1990. To march off on its own direction, and that was the death knell of the Soviet Union, because they couldn't survive without Ukraine. So I think that history is interesting and important. I try to tell it in a chapter or two, really, to try to, you know, hit the highlights there. But there's also, frankly, a practical component to the way that government functions, and which is, I think, you know, you would all recognize the bureaucracy that we had was entirely centered around Moscow. We didn't really have a diplomatic presence or an understanding of these republics. And they didn't have a means to advocate for themselves either early on. They didn't have a foreign policy establishment, a national security establishment. They had really limited, the limited features of running a state that they quickly kind of tried to develop, in part because, you know, I think you had a lot of leaders from Ukraine in the Soviet government that were able to come home and kind of, take charge and do things of that kind. But it is therefore pretty natural that you had a very, very Moscow-centric view back then. And folks that were stationed in Moscow and weren't stationed in Kiev were Moscow-centric. I think, you know, that might be a bit of a failure of Bill Burns to a certain extent in the way he managed the beginning of this full-scale war in 22 with a very, very Moscow-centric approach, that we didn't do enough to support Ukraine, that we were trying to manage and de-escalate Russia. I think that's a regular feature of a bureaucracy that's kind of organized and trained and developed in a particular way, plus being bad students of history and failing to understand who the Ukrainians were. I think that all is part of the reason that we took this approach. But we should learn the lessons of the past now, especially, and attempt to not repeat them. And Trump is, in a lot of ways, amplifying in the most disastrous and dangerous way the mistakes of the past. I'd say it's still part of the same pattern, but it is on a different level. So it's hard to discern whether it's different or not.
Yeah, I want to come back to that, Elliot. I do think the record should show that Alex does quite a good job of making clear that there were honorable exceptions in the bureaucracy to the prioritization of Russia.
Would I be looking at one of them, Eric?
He also, I think, does a much better job than some others have recently about telling the story of the so-called denuclearization of Ukraine. I mean, what Ukraine had was claim to, nuclear weapons that were on its soil, but were actually controlled totally by the Soviet strategic rocket forces and the Ministry of Defense in Moscow. And the Ukrainians themselves, I think, understood that for a lot of economic and technical reasons, maintaining an independent nuclear deterrent was kind of beyond their ken, in the early 90s, both because of the cost, but also just technically. I mean, the gravity bombs got moved out pretty fast, and then you had ICBMs that really weren't suited to actually be used against Russia because they were situated too close. The range of the missiles was too long, and they were situated too close to Russia to actually be effective.
And then the opportunity cost, you should briefly mention that, because it would have been burning bridges with the United States, which was dead set on denuclearization, non-proliferation, and the opportunity. Maybe they could have. I mean, they're obviously very, they could MacGyver just about anything, as we can see. But it would have been at a high cost and a high opportunity cost with regards to being able to get Western favor and transformation.
And I think it's also fair to say that, the concern about proliferation was not just an abstract kind of policy concern, because what was coming, and I think it was 95, was a review conference of the NPT treaty that was meant to make the treaty permanent rather than renewable every 5 years. And so it there was a real problem there. I wonder, you're pretty hard on the Obama administration in the book, rightly so, in my view, in terms of their response to the Russian invasion, the seizure of Crimea, and then the support for the destabilization, ultimately invasion of the Donbass. But I don't think they seem to get as much blame in the public discourse, as maybe they ought to, and as you suggest they should. Is there a reason for that, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say that, if I, this was completed, but the doctoral dissertation underlying this was completed in December of 22. Really, then the next year or so was rewriting the whole thing for just a trade press for general readership. And the newest part of it, so there was, the neo-idealism part is new and more advanced. And then the epilogue, which was written entirely in the 96 hours after the Trump administration. If I had it to do again, I'd be pretty darn damning of the Trump administration in a more comprehensive way. But I think that George Bush and Obama really kind of missed the import of some of the developments in that period of time. And Obama in particular undertook two things that were highly problematic. One is the reset on the back end of the Georgian War. So again, limited condemnation, really no conditionality. And that was on the promise of having working with, you know, a new leader in Medvedev, who's completely gone off the rails. And, you know, I don't think that was warranted. Every administration has tried to reset. Every single administration has tried to reset with Russia. And it's all kind of, you know, continuously blown up in our face because it's been, you know, we've been very forgiving. That the story is that we've been too harsh with Russia. We didn't account for, you know, their status or their pride or whatever the case may be. I don't think that's the case. Actually, I think we've been too forgiving. And then after the second revolution in Ukraine, you know, the revolution, the Ukrainians are very, very feisty. They will fight for their sovereignty and territorial integrity. We had another opportunity to really significantly transform the way we interacted with the region, and we missed that again. And part of that was this idea of you know, keep de-escalating, that Ukraine, you know, losing a sliver of territory is okay, without recognizing that the ultimate goal was basically what Zbigniew Brzezinski said, subordinate Ukraine, fold it back in to do some empire building. So you know, the Obama administration missed that and missed the opportunity to harden Ukraine, to make it a hard target for Putin to make it take another bite out of Ukraine down the road. So yes, definitely plenty of opportunity. But you know, Biden also, although he was much more hawkish in under Obama that we needed to do more, and including arming Ukraine, was also hyper focused on de-escalation without recognizing the long term consequences. I think the part of the story that's really interesting, and you know, Elliot, I think maybe this will resonate with you, is sometimes when we calculate risk, we should do it on the basis of consequence and probability. We focus on consequence almost entirely. So we attempt to mitigate the catastrophic consequences without understanding that the probabilities are infinitesimal, because Russia is not interested in a confrontation with the US, not interested in mutually assured destruction. So being resolved and holding our ground along the way could have been a significant deterrent. And we missed many, many opportunities to do so. And now we're completely, I'd say, capitulating to a Russia first policy in a way that's not going to in any way alleviate or accelerate the potential for peace, but make it a much, much more distant target and this is exactly what Trump is fixated on, but he's doing the exactly wrong things to get there.
So speaking of which, I wonder if I could just jump in on that. We are at a point which, you know, obviously Eric and I and many others have been talking about, where you have an administration that is shockingly sympathetic to Vladimir Putin, hostile really to Ukraine. But you also have a Ukraine that's been transformed by, you know, this horrific war which they've been waging. And, you know, how do you think this is all going to play out? I mean, I guess what it seems to me, and again, I'm in no way an area specialist, is, you know, however this terminates, whether it's with a ceasefire or a bigger peace agreement or no cessation of hostilities at all, you're going to have a Ukraine that is in some ways much more united, much more resolved, much more hardened, and which will have much more European backing than I ever would have expected. And so that will in some ways be that kind of harder target for Russia to gobble up. Would that be your assessment too?
I think that's true, but there are some black swan events that could unfold. The biggest one is potentially, you know, Trump could easily do something absurd like lift sanctions and give Russia a lifeline, and you know, alleviate the enormous pressures building on the Russian economy that look like they're coming to a head in 2025. That could change the dynamic in a fairly significant way. That would also potentially inspire the Chinese to believe that, you know, while the U.S. doesn't care, we'll go in far heavier for Russia, or in a way that they haven't done thus far. They've been undergirding the military industrial complex, but without, you know, providing weaponry and things of that nature. And they would do this in a way where Russia has a more decisive victory and provides them maybe breathing room in the Pacific in their aspirations for Taiwan. So, you know, these, that's, I think If those things unfold, that could be very dangerous. The base case is probably something closer to the fact that Trump doesn't have the Trump card. And the US plays a pretty significant role in Ukraine's defense, but it may not be decisive, or certainly not decisive in the short term. Maybe in the medium or long term, we're talking about, deeper, much deeper into this year, back half, back quarter of this year, where it looks, it starts to look differently. Because the way that US cutting off support unfolds is it builds. I think we're seeing some effects with regards to stopping intelligence sharing on Ukraine's ability to use long-range strike capabilities. But on the edge of the battlefield, they're doing pretty darn well. They've got a pretty darn good intelligence surveillance reconnaissance apparatus. I think that the material support is a little bit overstated, except in certain areas, interceptors for air defense. The other area would be artillery ammunition, deeper into the year. They'll be able to ration and do okay. And the other delta is how seriously the Europeans step up. Because the Europeans, as things become acute, the Europeans could step up in a bigger way. The Germans have the industrial complex and the wealth to do this, but they might not be there yet. Even as much as the what happened a week, 10 days ago on Friday in the Oval Office was a wake-up call and a moment of clarity. They still have some wishful thinking. They're deceiving themselves, not about Russia this time, but they're deceiving themselves about Trump. And what they're missing, I think, is critical. Something that Peskov and the Russians are saying is that there's a convergence of views between Russia and Trump America, which is this idea of Derzhavnost, great powers. And that in Putin's view, there's three of them. There's Russia, there's China, and the US. Everybody else is beholden. And Russia doesn't have the ability to play this out very well, but the US has, under Trump, being extremely coercive about small and medium states and flattering and pandering to large states. That's the way that both of them kind of see the world unfolding. So that's the big shakeup, frankly, bigger, much bigger than just Ukraine. It's the bigger geopolitical shakeup of a second Trump administration with no guardrails.
Alex, we want to let you go, but I've got one last question before we do, which is, you were kind of a witness to, the Trump-Zelensky relationship in 2019. A week ago, this past Friday, we had this remarkable scene in the Oval Office, this incredible meltdown with the Vice President and President Trump, seemingly taking great pleasure in humiliating Zelensky publicly and ganging up on him. I described it, in our podcast that we did that day as two schoolyard bullies sort of, beating up a handicapped kid. I mean, it was just awful to watch. How much of this do you think is just a personal grudge that Trump continues to hold from the Russia hoax, as he likes to call it, and the first impeachment? And how much of it is what you just were saying before, that that this is how he sees the world, the big boys, do what they can, and the middling and smaller powers suffer what they must.
It's interesting. First of all, I got to tell you, it was gut-wrenching to watch that because I had a moment of deja vu, thinking about what hand grenades going off, a fairly significant policy shift. I think that Trump and Vance intended to strong arm Zelensky, maybe embarrass him a little bit, but they still wanted to walk out of there with a deal. The problem is that Zelensky didn't do what the Republican Party has been doing. He had some spine defending his nation and making sure it was clear that it was the Russians that were the aggressor. I think it was the exact right thing to do. I know he's getting some the biggest he shouldn't have done that meeting in the first place. Just to be clear. It was foolhardy to walk in there thinking that he could transform the relationship. Because there is a deep animus towards Ukraine and affinity for Putin from Trump, and that Trump is vindictive. But I think that the fact is that he decided to go there because that's what leaders do. They figure out that they think they could swing it. And he stood his ground, which is really quite not typical anymore with regards to Trump. And I thought he, in the moment, in the same moment that Trump and Vance looked like bullies, they also looked weak, and Zelensky looked strong. And he had to do that because he was his most important constituency are the warriors on the battlefield, and the Ukrainian population, and then Putin across the way that couldn't see Zelensky be look made to look weak and fold. And I think, if you look at the epilogue of my book, I was pretty clear that, there was a good chance that this was going to happen on day one, that we were going to do a policy review and halt all support and manage to extend it out 5 or 6 weeks. But we got there anyway, just because of the disposition of Trump, vindictiveness, proclivities for Russia. So a lot of it wasn't a surprise, but the way that we conducted ourselves there was in a lot of ways important because the Europeans saw exactly who they were dealing with. And they allowed them to rally. They're not, they're just making the initial steps. I don't think they're there yet. They came out of that weekend afterwards thinking that there's a way for them to go back and flatter Trump, or Zelensky could come back and, do something to win him over. I think that's a mistake. I think the fact is that, we are unreliable for the next almost 4 years, and the Europeans are going to have to go it alone, and our allies in the Pacific are going to have to go it alone. So in a lot of ways, it wasn't a surprise, but it was also quite gut-wrenching.
Indeed, it was.
Yep. Well, Alex Vindman, thank you. Author of The Folly of Realism: How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk to you again because this story is not going anywhere. So
Thanks.
good luck on the rest of your book tour.
Thanks. Thank you, gentlemen, for both your support of my academic pursuits and the specific work. And I definitely look forward to joining at some point or another if I make the cut. Thanks.
So, Eric, we've both been writing. You beat me to it this week. What's been on your mind?
I barely beat you. Let's stipulate that it's not a Olympic timed event, but I and my colleague Frank Miller and frequent co-author were troubled by the fact that in that Oval Office meeting where President Zelensky was trying to speak about why it was he felt he needed security guarantees in the face of Vice President Vance's insistence that, President Trump, was now going to impose diplomacy on the players. He never really got to speak his piece. And what he was trying to say was that there were a number of ceasefires already that have taken place since 2014, all of which the Russians had violated. In fact, he had earlier given Keith Kellogg, the Ukraine envoy for Trump, a document that, laid out the 25 instances in which the ceasefire had been violated. And Frank and I, having been, long-term practitioners of arms control diplomacy, wanted to make the point that we, as the United States, apart from Ukraine, have our own experience with the Russians on arms control, which is that they violated some of the central agreements of the Cold War, notably, as we point out in our article in the Dispatch, the Krasnoyarsk Radar, which was a violation of the ABM treaty that went on for years and years. But also that Putin is currently in violation of at least nine arms control agreements that are extant and perhaps more, and that needs to be taken, into account as part of the record. So that's what I was up to. What were you and Phil O'Brien up to?
So Phil O'Brien and I we all gnash our teeth about different things at different times. That's one of the great opportunities this administration provides us. What we were gnashing our teeth about was something that both Trump and J.D. Vance were saying at that meeting, which is, you don't have any cards, you're losing, you're being defeated, and just wrong. And so we put on our military historian hats and said, look, let's talk a little bit about attrition, what attrition in war means. Let's look at the Russians. And, we talked through a whole bunch of things. Now, some of this is things that are pretty well known, that the Russian economy is very pinched right now with interest rates, 21, 22, 23%. Actually, the troubles of the Russian economy go a lot deeper. I mean, in some ways, it's almost deindustrializing in order to support this war. But then we just, we went in a mundane and, dare I say it, fairly grisly way through the casualty statistics. And if you look at, if you just take a look from December of 22, 23, and 24, which were the high points for Russian casualties, in 22, they're taking about 1,000, they're taking, I've got to get the numbers right, something like 500 casualties a day, then it's 1,000 casualties a day, and then 1,500 casualties a day. These are enormous numbers. And if you look at total casualties, the Russians, I think in 2024, were taking almost 425,000 over the course of the year, as opposed to about 250,000 the previous year. The point is, these numbers are not sustainable. The Russians are having tremendous trouble replacing their losses. They have to offer two and a half times the salary of the average Russian. And basically what they're doing is they're barely, they struggle to recruit numbers to cover their losses, which means that they can't really rebuild an army. And this is why, if you look at how they're doing on the front lines, they're not doing well. They're not, and the Ukrainians are doing a lot better. The Ukrainians are also being a lot more creative and innovative technologically. I mean, the Russians are in their way too, but the Ukrainians have been particularly successful. And even if you look at things like munitions production, first, the nature of the war has changed. So yes, the Russians produce a lot more artillery shells, but actually now about 70% of the casualties are coming from drones, which is a staggering statistic. And if you look at the war production that is increasingly available in Europe and not just the United States, there's no reason to think that, the Ukrainian side, to include obviously all of its backers, can't outproduce Russia and can't out-attrit them. So the idea that attrition is just a matter of the biggest side always wins, we call their attention to, say, Vietnam, which was an attritional war.
This, by the way, is the argument that J.D. Vance was very explicitly been making for months.
So, it was a mixture of history and some contemporary statistics, and really intended to get people off the notion, Ukraine is doomed because Russia, big country, Ukraine, smaller country, although actually still a very large country. That's just not so. And of course, what's particularly infuriating is people like Vance are saying this without actually looking at the numbers. I mean, truth is, I think he's sort of indifferent to the numbers. But
he doesn't know anything. I mean,
he really doesn't. And so there's that. I'm working on another piece right now, which maybe we can talk about next time, which is about the U.S.-European relationship. And, increasingly, maybe we should defer this. I'm increasingly of the view that we really are, to use a Muskian phrase, at a fork in the road, that it's going to be very, very difficult for the Europeans to ever trust us again after this, and particularly after that spectacle in the Oval. And my basic point is going to be that, don't kid yourself. You cannot trust this administration. But even after this administration, I've got a feeling Europeans are going to look at us and say, can we really count on the Americans in a crunch? And yes, with some administrations, and no with others.
Well, let me fill in your argument a bit, or, color in the lines a bit. You and I had the experience in the end of the Bush 43 administration of spending a lot of time with our European colleagues, particularly our UK and French colleagues, trying to, repair some of the breaches that had emerged over the war in Iraq. I mean, throughout the Obama administration, I think both you and I got an earful from them about how much they felt the Obama administration just didn't care about what Europeans thought about anything.
Right.
And that how little attention they paid to our European allies. including as we were just talking with Alex Vindman, you know, during the course of the Ukraine war, where we left them on their own. You know, we let them take the heat in the Minsk group. And then, of course, you know, got snitty over the fact that the Germans were prioritizing trade and good relations with the Russians as if we were going to do anything different. So there already was, I think, a kind of concern that that the United States was turning on its allies. If you look at what Barack Obama said in his famous interview with Jeffrey Goldberg about our allies, it was a much more polite and nuanced version of what Trump routinely says, which is the allies have taken us for suckers. You know, we've provided them with a lot of defense. They haven't stepped up. You then had the 4 years of Trump, obviously the first term, which was pretty shambolic, but obviously very, you know, dismissive of the allies and you know, very, you know, a lot of America first rhetoric. Even the Biden administration, which arguably made a fetish of the Americans are back and they're at the head of the table of all their alliances, et cetera, did very little to, in fact, didn't consult at all on the Afghan withdrawal, leaving our allies who were in Afghanistan with us holding the bag. And now you've got what, you know, what we've seen in the first 6 weeks of the Trump administration. If you were a reasonable European, what conclusion could you draw other than the United States is not really very reliable?
Right. And I, unfortunately, I think even when Trump has passed, and I do find myself thinking more and more about what the world post-Trump is going to be like. I'm not sure I could look at a European friend with a straight face and say, oh, don't worry, you know, we're going to swing back to being the, you know, reliable, protective Americans that we always were. I mean, it'll be much better, of course. But
there's been generational damage, and we need to understand that.
Well, there's been generational change. I mean, the same way that the world has changed because the World War II generation is no longer with us. So too, you know, the generation that was really formed by the Cold War is passing. You know, let's remember this: the Cold War ended 35 years ago. So somebody who is in their mid 40s or even 50. Which is, you know, that's usually the age when people begin to really have responsible positions in government. That was their teenage years, the Cold War, and it may not have shaped them very much. And before very long, that'll be 40 years in the rearview mirror. And, you know, in the same way that our relationship with, let's say, Germany was very different in 1975 than it was in 1945, well, I think something similar is going to be true of the Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, there's also going to be, I think, generational damage to the national security apparatus in terms of the flight of intellectual capital, which we're seeing right now.
Well, you know, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because one thing that I've been thinking about a lot is what I think of as the defense intellectual base. You know, there's a defense industrial base, and there's been a lot of good work, including at CSIS, where I am now, on the defense industrial base. There is a defense intellectual base, and I think it's going to take a hammering. I will not at all be surprised if the Doge types, but also sort of the Hegsethians, say, well, why do we need the federally funded research and development center? So again, for the benefit of our listeners, one of the things that the United States created in the early Cold War were these think tanks like RAND or MITRE or the Center for Naval Analyses or the Institute for Defense Analyses, which do an awful lot of work for the federal government of different kinds, some very technical, some kind of broad, much broader and strategic, which are funded as line items in the budget. And what that does is it makes them a lot easier for the customers in the Defense Department to say, we want RAND or some other FFRDC to do a study on this, that, or the other thing. You don't have to go through a separate contracting process because the money is there. But what you've also had is organizations develop which, at their best, you know, really are intellectually independent and I would at least say more willing to tell the truth, to speak truth to power, than consultants, kinds of companies that are always looking for the next contract. I think we're going to lose that. And I also think we're going to lose, we've already lost a lot of what was the intellectual base in the universities, which is something that we haven't noticed. You know, if you look in the 50s and 60s at the number of military historians and political scientists who were doing hard national security stuff, not war in society, not war in gender, but, you know, stuff that we would all recognize as being directly relevant to policy, those numbers have shrunk a lot. Yeah.
And that's been a long time, as a secular trend that's been going on for a while. I was really referring to, I mean, that's all true, and I worry about that as you do. I'm worried about the sort of flood of FSOs and Intel folks who are going to retire. They're eligible and they're going to retire. And what that means is that, you know, our viewers and listeners as taxpayers have paid for these people to be trained as subject matter experts, you know, for the better part of 20 years. And now in their mid-50s, when they're about to make the most significant contribution to advising senior leaders in the government, taking on senior roles themselves, whether as station chiefs or as ambassadors or DCMs or branch chiefs in the intelligence world, or, you know, directors, principal directors, deputy assistant secretaries, DASDs, et cetera, they're being cashiered. And you can't replace that. That's an investment in intellectual capital of 20, 25 years that you just cannot replace with intake, with new blood or something, because you've lost the language skills, the, you know, longtime study of different regions and countries, and it's not replaceable.
Well, and on top of that, you know, if you look at the way in which they're cutting out new classes from going into the Foreign Service or firing probationary appointees, it's not just that you're stripping out a couple of years worth of new entrants who tend to be bright and idealistic and energetic. You're sending a signal to a whole generation behind them that you really don't want to apply for a job in government because, you know, you can be thrown out on your ear by some, you know, wonderful phrase, socially maladapted, incel computer programmer. Yeah, I mean, it was as invective. I was really envious. But in any case, you know, I think the message that goes forth is, why would you expose yourself to that when you can make more money doing something else? So I really worry about the damage that will be done to the pipeline at the other end as well. So what does it mean you'll be left with? You'll be left with a lot of kind of early mid-career people who are fearful, because the reason why they want to stick it out is they want the pension, but they also, you know, they probably have spouses and kids. And so they will play along, you know? And so you don't have either the maturity of the most senior ones on the one hand or the energy and enthusiasm of the youngest on the other. And that's a recipe for mediocrity.
Yeah. What you'll have is political hacks and sycophants, and it's not a happy picture. I know you have got to go to do some other things, but I did want to turn to one other two other issues that, you know, just I think are worth commenting on. One is Adam Bowler, the U.S. Hostage envoy, has been having direct talks with Hamas. Apparently, this has not gone down well with our Israeli colleagues for obvious reasons. But of course, they're, well, to the point that Ron Dermer, advisor to Bibi Netanyahu, called Bowler, apparently was screaming at him, allegedly. Bowler has said, well, I don't really care you know, Ron Dermer can be mad at me, but, you know, I don't answer to him.
Right.
And this is a terrible precedent in my view, you know, having direct negotiations with a group that's designated as a foreign terrorist organization.
And the language that he was using, too, was driving the Israelis crazy about, well, you know, you need to get in touch with the sort of the human side of.
Well, and also equating hostages and prisoners as if they were equal.
Yes.
As part of this exchange. I mean, this is mind-blowing to me that the press is not covering this in more detail, because if this had happened in the Biden or Obama administrations, you and I would be jumping up and down, and so would, you know, most of the media. It would have been a five-alarm fire.
So I think the reason for, there are two reasons for that. One is, in general, the press has not done a great job of covering these kinds of stories, because they are letting themselves get distracted by, you know, Trump saying "Long live the king," you know, or silly stuff like that, and so they don't know how to focus on it, and they don't understand that, you know, going around your allies' back in this way, because the Israelis were not informed about this, is really very bad practice and counterproductive. So they don't pay attention to that. I think the other thing, frankly, is people feel, well, the Israelis are getting a really good deal from the administration anyway, so, you know, why should we waste any sympathy on them? And, you know, I sort of understand that. They see Columbia University just took a $400 million hit, you know, because of the way they dealt with anti-Semitic protests on campus. But I think, yeah. Well, I mean, this is a separate issue, but the damage that is being done to American universities, or potentially done to American universities, as well as to things like NIH, I mean, this is staggering. And they have not covered that well at all. There's been some coverage of, you know, what are the consequences of getting rid of AID, although very few people have gone into, like, PEPFAR, which has saved millions of people's lives.
Right.
And, you know, but people are not dwelling on it. But, you know, part of the insanity of the administration is they do want to destroy universities, which, whatever their problems, and, you know, as everybody knows, I know them very well from the inside, you know, are still these tremendous engines of scientific investigation and progress.
Right.
And they are perfectly happy to wreck them. I think the president of Hopkins recently said that, you know, the hits to AID and NIH alone, and that's quite apart from the indirect cost recovery stuff, could be an $800 million hit on the budget. That's a very large percentage of the Hopkins budget. Like, why do you want to destroy the greatest school of medicine and the greatest school of public health in the country?
Well, and our university system, which is one of our huge comparative advantages vis-a-vis, you know, the Chinese and the, you know, strategic competition with China. I mean, why would you want to, you know, destroy that? I mean, the other two stories that just, again, just drives me to distraction. President Trump yesterday, you know, said, confused Viktor Orban with Tayyip Erdogan, the leader of Hungary and the leader of Turkey. I only mention it's a slip. I only mention it, though, because you've drawn attention in previous podcasts to Trump's declining mental state and cognitive facilities. And, you know, if Joe Biden had done this, it would have been a 3-day story.
Yeah.
And, you know, nothing. And then the other story is that our friend and husband of occasional Shield of the Republic guest, Dan Applebaum, Radek Sikorski, the foreign minister of Poland, responding to reports that Starlink might be turned off for the Ukrainians, tweeted about this because, you know, Elon Musk sort of implicitly raised this in a tweet. Radek pointed out that actually the cost of the Starlink for Ukraine is being borne by $50 million worth of Polish funding, And that if in fact this was turned off, this goes to the earlier point about the Europeans on, you know, on their own, that they would find another way to do this, you know. And he was, you know, reproved by no less than the chief U.S. diplomat,
right,
Marco Rubio, who in a tweet said, "You haven't said you're grateful and thankful. You haven't said thank you." And then Musk chiming in saying, "Be quiet, small man." So I mean, this is how we conduct our diplomacy now.
Yeah, and look, first with Rubio, this is beaten child syndrome. You know, you get smacked around a lot. You look for somebody else you can smack around.
Right.
By the way, I think is the story of the childhoods of both Trump and Musk. They absolutely have no idea, I think, how to conduct foreign policy. But there's another dimension to this as well, which is, I think, in the long term, tremendously significant. And I know people in defense industry who absolutely feel this. This is going to motivate the Europeans to say, you know what? Instead of buying M1 tanks, let's buy Leopard 2s. Instead of buying F-35, let's buy Rafale or Gripen. You know, instead of using Starlink, let's put the money into our
Eutelsat.
And that's what's happening. And that's why if you look at the stock prices of European defense companies, they've gone up by like 20-25%.
Not to mention something you and I have been talking about repeatedly on this podcast, which is the prospect of people, you know, going it alone and developing their own nuclear weapons, as
Prime Minister of Poland just was talking about that. And by the way, the press, I mean, where was the big story in the press? If you had, look, part of how we got here was by having pretty terrible journalists. If the press was doing its job, they would go, whoa, the prime minister of a major country, which can develop nuclear weapons because it absolutely has the talent and the resources, has said they want to acquire nukes. That's a very, very big deal.
Right.
Crickets.
Right.
You know, if they only listened to us, Eric.
Indeed. Well, Elliot, I'm going to let you, you know, I know you've got some Polish colleagues to actually entertain. So I will let you go prepare. But thanks for, you know, as always, for, you know, straightening me out.
Well, and vice versa. Together, we'll straighten the rest of them out eventually.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.